Welcome to E-commerce Scaling Secrets podcast. So on this podcast, we interview the best minds in online advertising and in e-commerce. And I share my personal experience spending over $40 million on paid advertising annually for our clients and their own business. So welcome to this podcast, guys.
Hello, guys. Welcome to today's video. So today we have Zell Frampton. Zell is an amazing guy. He's CEO and founder at Dix. And they design, manufacture, and retail innovative pet supplies such as crates, gates, toys, and bowls via direct to consumer, direct sale, and Amazon. They have amazing products. They differentiate on innovation, branding, and use of technology. If you check out their products, they're I've never seen products like this before. So Zell, happy to have you here today.
Happy to be here.
Cool, awesome. And so, I mean, like, I look at the product that you guys are selling. So was it like initial concept of the business that you decided to disrupt this kind of like niche with the innovative products, or how did you come up with the idea for this business?
We actually came up with the idea for the business by looking at the pet industry kind of from a top-down perspective over quite a while. The pet industry has been changing pretty dramatically over the past decade or so. Using the buzzwords of the industry, we say pet humanization. In other words, treating pets like your kids or more like humans has led to product premiumization, which is a fancy way of saying people are spending more on their pets. And so what we saw was there's a ton of innovation happening in sort of the consumable segment. So that's dog food and dog treats, which is about half the industry. And then a lot of innovation and change happening in the services side of the industry. So think like services to connect breeders with the doctors or vets, things like that. But there wasn't enough innovation, we felt, for the supply segment, which is a big part of the market. And so we built a business with the idea of creating premium, innovative, high quality, and beautiful pet supplies, more akin to what you'd find in the baby industry or other consumer products industries that have kind of similar kind of product aesthetic and quality.
So in terms of the products, like how much, like did you first like validate it when you launched the product, or like you developed them first and then you launched them directly to the market?
We did a ton of research. It took 2 years to launch our first product. We do a lot of ethnography, which basically is a type of research that involves doing lots of observations of consumers, understanding what their pain points are, understanding what's an unmet need. It's very hard to do innovation out sort of doing very deep observational research. So we did a lot of research. We felt we had a pretty high conviction understanding the industry that there was a lot of room for improvement. And so we had to hire some pretty qualified designers to kind of come up with this unique design of our crate. And then we slowly validated the design of the concept over time, everything from showing early renders or videos to would-be consumers to, doing a Kickstarter and seeing what the reaction was to the design and the concept and what we were solving, to eventually like launching with just, one SKU, one size of our crate, when normally you'd have five or so sizes. We basically let data and the reaction drive higher and higher levels of conviction for progressing to the next stage.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's very like sophisticated. So is that like, because you have the background in like management consulting, correct?
I do. Yeah, I have a background in engineering, supply chain manufacturing, and then management consulting as well. And I have an MBA as well.
That's awesome. So you mentioned it took like 2 years before you just like launched the product for the first time.
That's right. Yeah, the concept was developed. Well, the idea was born, I should say, in 2016. And eventually we finally launched our e-commerce store in Q4 of 2018. So we've been in business about 2 years now.
How did it go like when you launched it?
It's hard to know what was our, I don't remember our expectations at the time, but it was slow, like out of the gates, right? I mean, it was, you hope for a really big splashy launch, and it takes time to build up the traffic and, getting, really understanding your customer and understanding how to message, what messages resonate, what ads will work, what channels will work, and so on and so forth. Getting validation like through reviews and third parties. It just takes time to build all that. But we had, I would say a number of sort of like inflection points, right? Where what I mean by that is business suddenly jumps. And that includes things like when we kind of figured out some of our marketing strategy, I would say, in Q1 or Q2 of 19, we finally figured it out a little bit who our customer was. And that was after doing some really good segmentation, understanding our customers better. We saw an inflection there. We saw an inflection when we launched our medium crate. Our business tripled overnight. We launched with just a small size. We launched with a medium size. in Q3 of 19. We launched on Amazon thereafter. And then we've had a number of inflection points in 2020. You know, we've been one of the beneficiaries of the COVID crisis, including the higher pet adoption rates and penetration of e-commerce. So we've had a number of those. And, you know, just as you sort of figure things out, you start to see jumps. And so, you know, things don't happen overnight. But when you look back 3 months, you're like, oh, my goodness, look at all the progress.
That's interesting. So was it like your first business or you had some other businesses before?
This is my first business where it's truly like a full-time and making a little bit of a career out of it. I've definitely had a few startups over the years. I had a painting business when I was an undergrad. I had like a team of 14 painters, you know, painting houses for me. I had a consulting business while I was at business school. But this is, you know, the first true full-time startup that I've launched.
So in terms of the, you mentioned at the beginning, when you just launched the business, you had, you know, that like learning curve was like dialing in the angles, the marketing, the messaging and stuff. So you use a Facebook ads, like typical, like standard flow, like ads on Facebook directly to the website, or was it something different?
You mean initially or over time?
Yeah, initially.
I think so initially we definitely launched with Facebook ads and Google ads. I think a really important thing we set up, one of the things that I think was smart to do right away is we set up relatively sophisticated email flows in Klaviyo out of the gates. So that was not something we waited on because I knew that we weren't going to generate a lot of traffic. So the key was to convert whatever traffic we did have. So we set up, I think those are our two main sources out of the gate. We also actually, I think we launched with PR also. You know, we thought that we had to get that external validation to prove that we were legitimate. Mm-hmm. So we hired a PR agency. We launched digital ads. We had the email set up. What else do we do out of the gate? I think that's it out of the gate.
Mm-hmm. And Amazon was like a secondary channel that you introduced later on?
A year later. Yeah. We've only been on Amazon for about a year now.
Cool. So how is it like, so over time, like, are you now like scaling up profitably with Facebook, or how is it, or you dependent on Amazon? How is the business evolved?
Well, we're on a bunch of channels now. So you can find us on Chewy, Petco, PetSmart soon, Wayfair, you know, a bunch of channels. We are scaling all of our channels nicely. As far as marketing goes, yeah, we've been lucky that we've scaled efficiently through digital ads. We've expanded, we've, you know, grown, but we've also diversified quite a bit away from digital ads. We're really focused on, you know, lots of other channels, including affiliate marketing, influencers, pet professionals. Community building is a big one for us now. We've done some, you know, we've played with things like SMS. We've played with, you know, YouTube. We've done, I'm sure I'm missing some stuff here, but yeah, those are the main ones that we're kind of like really focused on right now.
Do you still like dedicate a lot of resources to like product improvement and development?
That's our secret sauce. Yes. I mean, products, you know, we are a product company and particularly an innovative product company. So yeah, we're raising around to build out a pretty significant R&D team to build out our product suite. And I would call our core competencies marketing and product development, with product development being sort of fundamentally who we are and what we are. And going back to my earlier comment around when we've seen step changes in the business, it's always been with product launch. You know, customers are really responding well every time we launch a new product. And I think that's because of the thought, the time and effort that goes into understanding and creating something pretty unique in the marketplace.
That's awesome. So the with repeat purchase ratio, like, do we get customers to buy like more than once? Because these are type of the products that are, you know, they look like very sturdy and solid.
Yeah, we do have some people who buy multiple crates. I think the bigger indicator. So right now, the way our suite is set up is we have two crates in two sizes. We have a small and a medium. And then it comes in three colors now, a gray, a black, what we call charcoal, and a light color called ash. We have a snooze memory foam pad that goes with it that comes in two sizes and four colors. We have a one-of-a-kind dog crate training aid to help with the crate training process. And we have we just launched a brand new, extremely innovative cover for the crate. So as you can see, we have sort of this hero product with associated accessories. And we find that customers really do understand the benefit of the kind of buying all the accessories, because we have a very high sell-on rate for our various accessories. Our average order value is quite high. Our LTV is quite high, but most of it's earned up front. You know, we're going to, in 2021, we'll be launching more products within our crate suites, but we'll also be launching entirely new product suites as well.
So basically all of the products that you sell, you guys directly manufacture, you have like the full control from the initial like development to the distribution and sales process?
Yes, we partner with a third third-party manufacturers.
Sorry about that.
Your question was our supply chain, right? So we work with a number of third-party manufacturers. They're great partners for us. And then we have a head of supply chain who manages the inbound freight to our warehouse and from our warehouse to either directly to our end customers or to our retailers.
From the perspective of like COVID and impact, so you mentioned it positively impacted your business as a whole, but did you have like any logistic issues when, for example, the lockdowns and everything had been introduced?
Of, like, sure. Getting the product out here? Yeah, and we continue to this date. Because of our growth, we are struggling with getting enough capacity on the vessels, on the boats to bring our product in. Our products are getting stuck at the ports. Right now, we have a lot of products stuck at the Port of Los Angeles and Long Beach that we just can't get out of the port. So yes, we've definitely had logistical headaches. Costs have gone up from that regard. I would say that, you know, like everyone else, we're all working remotely as a team now. That's added sort of complexity, not just from a culture standpoint, but also from a product development standpoint, because when you're building products, you need to tinker things, you need to build, test, iterate, and that's much harder in a remote setting. So there's no question we've had a lot of operational challenges as a result of the COVID crisis. But we do consider ourselves, all things equal, lucky compared to a lot of folks who obviously are struggling in this time pretty significantly.
When you launched on Amazon, you had like the traction like right away, or it took some time, some ads, some acceleration to get momentum with it?
It's a bit of it. Amazon is definitely a snowball or a flywheel. In other words, once you figure it out and you and the pieces start to work, then it accelerates tremendously. But it took us a while, you know. So we launched, I want to say, I think it was October 2019. I don't think we cracked the nut, so to speak, until April of this year. So it took us, you know, maybe 6 months, 7 months to really get it. And it was up and down, and we had issues sort of figuring out sort of the right inventory levels. We didn't figure out AMS properly, Amazon Marketing Services. We didn't really figure out the page listings all that well. And so, you know, once we sort of figured that out, and then we started to get a lot of product reviews, and then we started to get really high on the search results for like generic terms, like quote unquote dog crate, just the most generic term. We're now on page one, then everything accelerates. So we've seen like, you know, our Amazon is like flat bump, and then like that.
How do you like, what's your like thought process for figuring out like a new sales channel? Like, so you mentioned you've experimented with this channel, with Amazon, with YouTube, with other, like, do you just like get your hands dirty? Like you start experimenting or have like a team member to do that? Or you bring someone in like an agency or a consultant and like, okay, tell me everything, like what we need to know about this platform. And then you just use that as an initial kind of a foundation?
That's a great question. It's a bit of an all of the above is the answer. So we are, and our origins are direct to consumer. And so I would say that our skill are much more as the origins of our skills are much more as a retailer. So being a direct to consumer retailer. So it was definitely a learning curve moving into other channels. For Amazon, we initially, sometimes there's a correlation. I don't know if it's a causation, but we started off using an agency that specializes in Amazon. And one of the reasons, and we moved away because we thought performance was not very good. Once we moved away and we took control of more of it, and we kind of figured out the what we need to do as a brand a little bit more, that's when we saw that the performance really pick up. I've had a mixed bag with agencies kind of at the most generic level. My experience with an Amazon agency, I was quite poor, but there are good ones out there, I'm sure. And we've had some good experiences with our current digital media agency in terms of AMS. They've done a great job there. So that was for Amazon. But then we also have we hired a head of sales at the beginning of 2020 who has done an excellent job, not only getting us into new channels, but then managing those channels as well. So we have, at this point, I would say, we are skilled at all types of retail at this point, but we had to learn that over time. And like anything, if you do it well in-house, it'll be better than if you outsource it. It depends on your scale and how much of a strategic focus that is for you.
Cool. So where do you see the like direct to consumer? Obviously, you know, it's been like overhyped, right? Over some period of time, there've been companies that like overfunded, couldn't make it happen. Like, the examples, where do you see it going like over time? Are they like companies looking now from, you know, be like self-sustainable, profitable, and then gaining, you know, for example, funding and everything, or it's still like there's a lot of like money, like everyone wants to fund the deep, if it's like direct to consumer?
I believe very strongly that there's going to be a good business case with direct to consumer businesses if they're run in the right way. I think what you're referring to are going back, let's say 10 years, over the last between 10 years and 5 years ago, there was a lot of venture capital that was going into direct-to-consumer businesses on the premise that you could continue to buy customers on Facebook endlessly and fund a business that way and make a sustainable business that way, because one day you'll turn off Facebook and ta-da, you have a self-sustaining profitable business. I don't think that's, I think that that concept has largely been proven to be incorrect. There are some exceptions to that, but largely to your point, that hasn't proved to be true. That doesn't mean that there are not amazing opportunities for direct consumer businesses. And I think there's plenty of good examples on the contrary. I think what makes direct to consumer so amazing is that as a retailer, you get to have a direct relationship with your customer. As a brand, I mean to say, you have a direct relationship with your customer. And I think that is really important because you can respond to feedback on your products, on your brand, on your, you know, how you talk about things in a very real-time way that you can't ever do if you're going through third-party retail. Add to the fact that you get to keep more of your margin and or pass some of that on to your customer, you have a pretty winning formula. The question is, how do you reach your customers? And how do you do so in a way that's sustainable? So I think the best direct-to-consumer businesses are ones that have combination of all the following. You don't have to have all of this, but some combination of high average order value, high lifetime value, and sustainable cost of acquisition. And you don't need to, I think you need to have a, you know, a relatively strong lifetime value to customer acquisition cost to be sustainable over time. Now, the thing that I think is really important here, speaking directly to your original question, is there's only so much you can scale and do so profitably through digital advertising generally. Now, some there, again, there's exceptions and whatever, but I think the businesses that are the most intriguing direct-to-consumer businesses are those that have cracked the nut on how to acquire customers in a unique and novel way, in a way that's very kind of organic and sustainable. You know, whether that's through word of mouth or it's through like content or other things that become sort of a viral, you know, sharing type thing. I think that's how you continue to create awareness. And then once you reach scale, it becomes more like a traditional sort of brand where you can diversify your channels, you can diversify your marketing, and it becomes more about just brand awareness rather than sort of driving direct conversions on your website. And then, you know, as long as the numbers continue to work out, you'll have a good business. I do think that there is definitely, I think the future, there's a huge part of the future is direct to consumer businesses. And I think that's, you know, evidenced by, you know, investors feel the same way just by, you know, their enthusiasm for Shopify and how that stock price is done, for example.
How is it, how do you handle the competition? Like, do you observe them, learn from them, or do you just like ignore and like focusing on customer and like, you know, the feedback you get directly? What approach do you take?
Well, I think ignoring your competition is foolish. There's no reason to ever do that, right? I think at the very least, you want to know, what are they doing? Why? What do they see that I don't see, et cetera? But I also believe, and this is a little bit of what, you know, I believe very, very strongly in the secret sauce of Digs in terms of our ability to identify unique opportunities and design unique products. So I'm not threatened by competition. I think of it as like that, okay, that's what are they learning? But I think given the size of our market and the size of the opportunity for us, I'm not too concerned. I'm more focused on the customer. And what does the customer really need, and how are their net needs not being met at the moment?
How do you handle, like, so that initial period of time when you expected that, like, very, you know, significant launch, it might have, like, not been as, you know, as successful as you thought it would be. So how do you go through these, like, obstacles, like, mentally mostly? Like, how do you overcome those? Do you have, like, mentors, or you have, like, family members that support you, or... like, how do you go through those like tough periods?
Yeah, look, I think being an entrepreneur requires a lot of resiliency. I think that's number one. I think that's probably the, you know, I think the studies have shown one of the common denominator between successful entrepreneurs is resiliency, because you're going to have ups and downs. Your job as a CEO is actually more problem solving than, you know, sitting back and enjoying. You know, it's just you go from one problem to the next, and as the business grows, the problems get a bit bigger, and you get used to solving them. So I think from I think your question though was like, who do I have around in my network to help? We do have some advisors. I think the most helpful thing that I ever did, and I did this probably earlier than most in sort of our life cycle, is I instituted a board of directors, and we have quarterly board meetings, and we did that starting less than a year into launching the business. So sometime at less, you know, maybe 9 to 12 months or so from launch. And what that did was it had very smart and sophisticated people committed to the business from both from a, you know, they're compensated, let's say, with options, but they're also compensated. They also have, you know, duties as board members to the business, fiduciary duties specifically. And so they hold me and my management team accountable quarterly basis. And it's a great way to step back every 3 months, look at the business holistically. You know, are we doing the right thing? How are we doing? Is this the right strategy? Where are the issues? How do we solve it? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think good governance is one of the best ways to kind of keep you on track and make and help you see the wood for the trees. Because when you're in the business day to day, all you see are the problems. When you step up, step back and look at the big picture, you're like, hang on a second. It's been 6 months, but look how much we've grown in 6 months, or look at what our customers are saying about us in 6 months. You know, that's actually pretty good when I tell a story about this and have to tell other people what's going on. I think people will go through some similar kinds of high level reviews if they go into fundraising. But I do think that if you're not going that route, one of the great things you can do is governance.
Such a good point. How do you find like board members? That's a question. How do you find like good like board members? Like how do you like what's typical like structure? I mean, obviously that could be like confidential, but like what's typically the compensation or kind of like incentive base for them to be, you know, board members and also dedicate some of their time and resources to your business?
Look, I think in the early days, it's going to be people in your network, right? It's going to be, hey, do you know, pick a family member's neighbor who happens to be a sophisticated business person. Hey, so-and-so person, would you be interested in joining our board? When you're an older, particularly older people who are kind of closer to retirement or post-retirement, who are like, they love being part of a startup, right? It's like, it's fun for them, right? So as long as they believe in what you're doing, believe in you as an entrepreneur, I think it's not that hard to convince them. Add to that, if they get compensated typically with options, you know, 0.5%, 1% depends on like, you know, percent would be a lot. 0.5% is probably typical. You know, if they're compensated with options or something like that, you know, they're going to be all the more incentivized. Later, of course, as your business becomes more sophisticated and you're actually showing real growth and traction, then it becomes a totally different story. But I think in the early days, it's like, who in your network do you think could be a valuable person to be a sounding board? And, you know, can you get them excited about what you're doing? The one thing I would recommend though is you don't want people on your board who are going to be either challenging to work with for what, like your personalities clash very in a very bad way. But counter to that, and probably more importantly, you don't want yes people. You don't want people who just come in and say, yes, 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 great job. That's actually pointless. You want people who are going to challenge you.
Okay, cool. Some notes. In terms of the team members, like what, and over like the team structure, like what responsibilities like you still take, like and kind of like what things you still do, or whether like you like just micromanage or like have just team members do and like taking like full responsibility for the tasks. How do you approach that?
Well, I would never advise micromanaging. If you have to micromanage, I think you either have a problem as yourself as a manager, or you have a problem with the people on your team. But what I would say is, I think your question is ultimately, how do you think of, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your question is, how do I think about over time building the team and delegating? Is that a fair
interpretation
of your question?
It's kind of like, how do you do it in a way where it's like, you still maintain the control of the company and the main functions and the main things, you know, so it doesn't go out of control. And same time, you know, as the company grows and expands without obviously sacrificing like most of your time for it.
Yeah, I think the secret sauce is hire good people. Honestly, you know, that's the most important thing as a CEO is, can you hire, train, mentor, and retain excellent people? Because if you hire excellent people, and I don't even mean good people, I mean excellent people. If you hire excellent people, then it's very easy to let go.
You said not good people, but excellent people.
Yeah.
Good is not enough.
Good is not enough. If you want to really let go and really fly, have the company fly, no, you need excellent people. And that's probably the hardest thing, is to find those people. But I think that's your job as CEO, frankly. It comes a point where you need to really get people who are motivated, who share your vision, but the best thing you can do is get out of their way. Never mind micromanage, but it's really like, how do you get out of their way and let them flourish as individuals and as like, you know, within their own roles. But as a CEO or manager, depending on your role, I think it's very important that you're setting clear expectations, clear targets. And we have a culture at Digs, and I believe in this very strongly, of extremely transparent and open feedback. You will never get a semi-annual review without hearing both what you're great at, because I believe in focusing on people's strengths and what are you really strong at, but also where do you have to grow? You're never going to get hey, you're doing a great job, pat on the back and keep going, right? It's always like, you're great, you're excellent, but how do you get even better? And so we talk about, we have very open culture of feedback and both ways. You know, I try to instill in everybody that they can give me feedback, I will give them feedback, and that's part of, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's part of like the culture, and that's how everyone kind of grows and now you can build trust. But I think as far as understanding what's going on, you know, there's tactics, things like, you know, one-on-one meetings, and there's project plans and project managers and things like that. But I think ultimately, if you set the goals and let excellent people do the work, you know, it'll work out.
Awesome. How do you typically find good people? Like, is that through your network, LinkedIn, recruiting companies? Like,
it's been a mix, you know, and I'll be the first to admit we've had a few spectacular hiring failures, like truly spectacular, like, you know, within a month. No, we're gone. So it's not easy. Like, let me be the first to admit it. I think the best people, you know, and I'd say there's four people on my leadership team, and three of them, I would call them really organic hires in the sense that we met in different capacities in life, whether it's a conference or did work for me, let's say, as a consultant. And then, you know, you maintain those relationships and you realize this person shares my values, shares like the vision, and you kind of say, hey, come join the team, and you really kind of coach and mentor them. And I think that's been the best. We've had a phenomenal hire through, you know, using LinkedIn and sort of typical interview process. And we've had a lot of okay, decent stuff through kind of recruiters and stuff, you know, which have been very, you know, a lot of, you know, very solid, you know, really good people through recruiters. But, you know, there's been some mistakes as well. But, you know, I think the important thing is you will make mistakes in hiring, but can you realize and respond quickly and sort of like say, this is not working, and not just keep something or somebody on a team that's detrimental to your progress or to your objectives.
Do you kind of like choose people according to their track record, or do you also find some like young, hungry people that might not have like track record, but like just pushed or, you know, passionate about like what has been the best hires?
It's actually an excellent question, because I'm of the belief that I will take smart and ambitious and motivated over experience any day of the week. Because unless you're talking about a very technical role where you just, like, for example, a graphic designer has to know how to use Illustrator. If you don't know how to use Illustrator, or you don't know how to create graphics, you've never done that before, you've never taught how to do that, it doesn't matter how smart you are. Like, it's just going to be like impossible to use you in that capacity. You know, similar if you're, you know, an engineer and you can't use CAD software, like, doesn't matter, you know. But those types of roles aside, where it's extremely technical, or there's a technical entry point that you need to have, I will always take intellect and motivation and shared values over experience. Because the difference is, someone who's very experienced but mediocre in terms of intrinsic talent will have a very low will hit the ground running very quickly, but will then have a low ceiling. Someone who is intrinsically talented but may not have the experience will be slower out of the gates, because they do have to learn how to do the role, you know, how to be professional, but their ceiling could be much higher. And that's much more interesting over the long term.
That's such a good point. So in terms of the like remote culture right now, so you mentioned that you have people like in-house, like, you know, you had people in the office, now it's more like remote. Do you like, let's say lockdown will be over, like, do you plan to continue with like hiring people remotely, opening up like, you know, obviously you can hire people from anywhere in the world, anywhere in the US, or it will still be like, the local, and you want to build a company kind of in-house, where everyone interacts with each other?
Look, I think like a lot of businesses, we're still figuring that out, right? I think that we're entering a new kind of, some people are saying it's the next industrialization phase, you know, of remote work, and the world is changing that way for good. I think only time will tell. What I can say is at the moment, we are hiring people who are not in New York City. We are hiring kind of people, and we do have some really good people sort of all over the country. And we find that for the most part, there's some exceptions. Like I think I mentioned earlier, product development is more challenging remotely, but for the most part, people are very capable given the tools we have today to work remotely and are doing so well. You know, my thinking is once things return back to normal, let's say fall of 2021 is sort of like the target we have in our head. We would like to have a much more hybrid approach where we'll have an office where we can do a lot of the product development stuff that we need, a place to get together and kind of share ideas. And because there is a lot of benefit to being in person, but also make the work just much more flexible, whether that's you know, work from home 3 days a week in the office 2 days a week, or, you know, some roles totally fine to be permanently remote. I think we're definitely going to be shifting. I don't think over the long term, we intend to be 100% remote for good. I just don't think you could build, it's hard to build a culture that way. And it's isolating after a while. And I think people feel that, right? But there's no reason to believe that people can't be successful remote at this point. I think it's been proven. So it's how do you find the right balance that, you know, achieves all of those objectives at the same time. So I don't think we've solved it. I think we have our ideas for what we want to do, but only time will tell.
Cool. So how do you manage like business and personal, right? Like, do you, for example, dedicate some time for the family? So that's just block time. Like no devices, no phone, or it's like mixing with each other and like business just part of like personal life as well.
Yeah, that's honestly a challenge, right? I think any entrepreneur will tell you that it can become an obsession of yours, like to constantly be working on the business.
Yeah.
So I don't think that that's like an easy answer. What I do is, you know, I've got kids. I try to spend, like I get up pretty early and I try to spend the morning with them until it's time to kind of get log on. I try to put them to bed and bathe them and definitely spend weekends with them. So I do try to carve out time, but I am one of these people that can sort of compartmentalize, you know, basically put things in a box in my mind. So I find it easier to just sort of be on my phone periodically, you know, just checking things, moving things along, rather than, you know, being totally on or totally off, sort of like somewhere in between a lot of the time is better for me. But I think that's a pretty personal decision and everyone will work differently. I think if you want it to be sustainable over the long term, though, you do have to find ways of disconnecting and keeping your hobbies up and keeping your friends and relationships up. Otherwise, it's just not going to work for you and you're going to burn out. But look, I think it's not easy. I think it can become, people are passionate about their businesses and getting them to be successful. So
what would be you work with, you know, in management consulting space, you've seen a lot of businesses there, you have friends, you have like, you know, from your whole experience, you know, seeing entrepreneurs, seeing different businesses, what have been like, you know, your main observations where entrepreneurs like go wrong, like main three mistakes from, you know, from your observation?
Where do they go wrong in terms of their management decision-making or in terms of?
Yeah, in terms of, let's say, you know, for example, there's like, you know, many businesses that, I mean, if you look at on the street, like there are many like small businesses, right? And there are businesses that have, you know, like of tremendous scale, right? You know, what kind of like mistakes people typically do that don't allow them to scale up?
Look, I can't say that I've done a deep study on this. So this is going to be kind of like my observations. I think there's probably different types of failure, right? And they happen at different stages. Right. I think there's failure before you even start. And what I mean by that is there are people who start businesses that have very little chance of success, either because they don't truly understand the market they're entering. They're entering a very, very small market with no growth, or they don't have the skill set to be successful, or, you know, basically, you know, the expression dead in the water. I think some people are not thoughtful enough about, why am I getting into this business? Why me?
You told like it took like 2 years for you to launch the product. And I'm saying, wow, that's a lot of time. But then I'm thinking, geez, like you already at that point, I mean, you have something that now your competitors, maybe competitors, not as, but like, let's say they see the product. Oh, they say, well, we need to develop similar product. Now it takes them like a year or two to develop something similar, right?
Oh, I lost my video again, looks like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think the case for us was, just honestly, you had to get funding. You know, our products are expensive. And so you needed funding. We needed, you know, it takes a long time to design. And I would say that's a little bit different than what I was getting at. I think in those 2 years, I did a lot of that sort of initial analysis. I'm talking, even if you have all the money, even if you have the ability to kind of do everything, understand why you're starting a business. Is this a good market? Do I have the skills required? Does it make sense? You know, I think, don't make sure that you have a real opportunity here and that you understand. I think the second thing is some people don't know how to, you know, don't have, I think, some basic understanding of business that allows companies to kind of be sustainable, right? Very fundamental. Some people have a knack, an intuition for it. And even if they don't have the training, they understand it or they get it quickly. But some people don't take the time to learn. And I think what that means is, you know, they don't understand margins. They don't understand, you know, like ultimately, how does this business make money or monetize money? They just say, they think, hey, let me make a cool product, or let me, you know, make a cool app. But how does this business make money, right? Like, and then can you manage your cash? Like, do you run out of money? So I think there's a little bit of financial acumen that has to come along with sort of like the gumption and the excitement of starting a business. And then the third thing is, are you someone who knows how to scale? I mean, going back to your question like half an hour ago about how do you kind of let go and let your people kind of take over and give them the room to grow and whatever. I think, you know, some entrepreneurs don't know how to be managers. They know how to like create a great first product or know how to, they're killer on social media or whatever the case may be. But scaling a bit, you know, the early stage successful entrepreneurs are not necessarily the later stage, you know, CEOs. Like, can you let go? Do you know how to like run a business rather than like start a cool idea? And that's why you sometimes see when venture capital funds or whatever, you know, come in, they'll often, you know, replace a CEO because they don't know how to scale. So I think there's different types of failure along the way. And, you know, I think it's just depends on kind of where you are and have you been thoughtful about what you need to do to be successful at every stage of the business.
Such a, you know, different. You have very interesting perspective. Very interesting perspective. The from the perspective now of your business, like, so you guys are looking like more like retail. So that's where you see like most of the opportunity, or like scaling with like new product launches. How do you see that?
I think we have a lot of growth vectors that we're going to be pursuing simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I think number one for us is new product. We have so much new product we want to bring to market. Number two would be expansion within our existing retail channels. You know, we're growing like crazy on channels like Chewy, but we've only scratched the surface. There's so much room for growth there. There's a ton of room for growth on all of our channels, including direct to consumer. There's room for growth in international markets. A lot of the trends I referred to right at the beginning in terms of, I use the words humanization to premiumization, that's happening around the world. Major markets like China are going to be very attractive to us. And so we do want to grow internationally at some point. And then there's, you know, a lot of things we can do in terms of vertical integration, you know, owning our own manufacturing and things like that, that'll bring us sort of even better unit economics over time.
Awesome. Thanks, Del. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I've learned so much. I took notes about the board. I've took notes about the team building. It's been very informative. Thank you, man. Where do people find you? Like, how people connect with you?
Check out our website, www.diggs, that's diggs.pet, P-E-T. Mm-hmm. That's our website. You can find us on Instagram, DigsPet, or anything, anywhere on social media. You can also find us on Amazon, Chewy, Wayfair, Walmart, Petco, soon PetSmart. I think that's it. Hopefully I'm not missing any.
That's awesome. Thank you for taking the time. I know you're a busy business owner, so thank you for taking time for this call. And thank you everyone for listening. I'll have the notes. I'll have the links that I mentioned. And thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.